Thursday morning in New York City. How you feeling? My name is Mark Farrell. The show is Insight on Progressive Radio Network. Thursday. I like to call it Friday Eve. Yeah. So are you more in the holiday spirit than you were last week? I got some emails like, Mark, you better get in the holiday spirit. It's December. I know. Well, it was only December 1st last week, so give me some break. I'm getting there. We got a great show, as usual. We're going to be talking about sex, drugs, and rock and roll. How's that for a tease? And some more things with Tracy Jackson. She co-authored a great book with unbelievable, talented musician Paul Williams. Yes, you know Paul. He even won a Grammy a couple years ago. The name of the book is My Notes Are in a Mess Today, Gratitude and Trust, Six Affirmations That Will Change Your Life. New York Times bestseller. You know it because it's probably on your table next to your bed or in your office, or you gave it to somebody for a present. Or if you haven't, you probably will be buying it for yourself or giving it to somebody for a present, because when you hear how helpful it's going to be, yeah, you'll be doing just that. So, it was a crazy week so far. We had a Laugh or Sight on Tuesday. Brian Fisher was on our show last Tuesday to promote Laugh or Sight, the 11th annual Laugh or Sight, that benefits degenerative retinal diseases. And that's actually kind of a mouthful, but after you've had a few cocktails when I'm up on stage, it's even harder to actually get out smoothly. But it was a great event, so I want to thank all you guys for coming out on Tuesday night, Monday night, actually. I see it's been a long week at Gotham Comedy Club on 23rd Street. Hey, some comedic icons. Robert Klein, again, does not disappoint. And I didn't realize this until a couple weeks ago. I knew he had two kids, which, if you remember, years ago when they got divorced. Do you remember that? It was crazy. They actually painted a line, I think, down the middle of the kitchen and in the house they lived in Westchester. And it was, they didn't want to give up their residence because it would be a child custody case. It was crazy. Anyway, so his son, Allie Klein, was on stage, and he was incredible. Very witty, charismatic, just like his father, but more of a younger version, more of a millennial, of course, because he's in his 20s. But it was great. Joy Behar, incredible. Never watched The View. Not my cup of tea, obviously working, but even when I did catch clips of it. But when she was on stage, she really, really pulled out all stops. Actually, she was pretty funny because she pulled out a list of the latest Trump appointees. So, of course, it's very topical. And rightfully so, she went down a list and had a lot of fun with all the candidates. It actually looked and sounded like an SNL skit. And speaking of SNL, so Alec Baldwin was going to give up, or will give up, doing his shtick on Trump if Trump produces his tax records. What do you think? I don't think it's going to happen. I think Alec has a full-time job for at least the next 4 years. Easily. But anyway, Laugh or Sight was great. Again, benefiting degenerative retinal diseases. And New York City's Alliance was there in support. Maria Melito, my friend and also host, DJ on Q104.3, New York's Rock Experience, was there, and she's phenomenal. And a lot of other great people who support Brian Fisher's effort. And Brian has RP, retinitis pigmentosa, and went blind years ago. And his desire and willingness to blaze new trails just really is astonishing. Because you know what? It's not easy when you're blind. And to take on an endeavor like this and to get world-known comedians, such as Seinfeld, who was there 2 years ago. The guy who does one-liners very dry? Stephen Wright. I mean, he's had everybody. Except for Bill Cosby, and I don't think we want Bill Cosby. So, but it's been great. The turnout's been great, and I appreciate your support. And of course, if you're willing to donate for degenerative retinal diseases, you can always go on for laughforsight.com. That's laughforsight.com. Brian Fisher, the founder, he's also a comedian, and he killed it. And if you didn't hear him last week, you can go on my archive page, Insight page, and listen to last week's show with Brian Fisher. It's great background. You can hear how Charlize Theron literally fell over him, and that's how he met her on the red carpet, and some other interesting things. And it's kind of a sad thing, actually. He told me, confessed on the air here last week, that he despises Halloween, and it happened after he was on my show a couple years ago, because after leaving my Soho studio, when I was on 101.9 RXP, the Rock Experience, he walked down, and it was the day of the Halloween parade in the village, and some guy passed him and said, "Ha, a blind guy, what a brilliant costume." Yeah. So could you imagine cringing and hearing that? You probably just want to go home and bury your head or lips in a bottle or something, obviously, because it's not very uplifting. So I urge you, if you didn't hear that interview, go back and check that out. So, you know, you've heard me speak about a lot of different things on this show. I've overcome a lot, certainly with drugs and alcohol, mental illness. You know, who hasn't? You know, we all have issues, all have experiences, and they all shape us, right? Because that's who we are. And if you don't kind of, you know, find a strength and you sit on the sidelines of life, you know, there's not much to life. And I heard about a book a while ago, actually, Gratitude and Trust, written by Tracy Jackson and co-authored by Paul Williams. Paul Williams is an unbelievable artist, a writer, Grammy Award winner, and so much more. He's just really a tremendous guy. And together, they coupled up. And they wrote a book that became a New York Times bestseller list. And it came out a little while ago. But still, the sentiments and the tenets are timeless. And that's why I welcome Tracy Jackson to the show. She wrote films, Confessions of a Shopaholic, great movie, The Guru, The Other End of the Line, among others. She has written 12 TV pilots and also actually is in, I believe, writing another one right now. Created the series Babes for Fox TV, and she wrote and directed and starred in the controversial documentary Lucky Ducks, her first book, Between a Rock and a Hot Place, Why 50 is Not the New 30. We're going to talk about that. Came out in 2011 as an option for a TV pilot. Tracy joins me now, and I'm so happy to have Tracy here. Hello, Tracy.
Hello, Mark. Happy to be here.
Oh, you're a New Yorker. I love it.
Sort of. I'm a New Yorker by way of California.
Do you like it, and was it a hard transition?
No, you know, I always wanted to live here. I've lived here on and off my whole life, my adult life. And I go back all the time. My family's still there. So I kind of have the best of both worlds. When I get sick of it here, I go to work there. But I'm, you know, I New York's a little tense right now. I'm wondering how some of your New York listeners are dealing. I mean, that traffic and the street closures. I think people are getting a little nervous, you know.
Do you think it's New York or it's the United States in general?
Well, I don't
think. The new landscape, the new world we live in, post-Trump.
I mean, post-Trump in my neighborhood is literally every street's blocked off with, like, guys with big machine guns and
so you're
dogs.
You're loving life now.
Well, you know, I love life when I close the door right now. But it's, I think, you know, I look at the people and I'm seeing a lot of nervous faces and I'm seeing a lot of jumpiness. I think that it's a little tough for people right now. I think tougher than they planned on.
So you're pretty resilient.
Ooh.
Wouldn't you say so? I mean, you've been through a lot in your life, and that's one of the reasons why you've written this book. Starting with your parents getting divorced at age 4 and not seeing your father for a few years. And
I mean, most of my life.
Most of your life. It takes
yeah,
a
still
toll.
Still not.
Still.
You know what? I do think I'm resilient. And people ask me about that. They'll say, you know, how do you bounce back? How do you keep going? I think that's one of the biggest questions that I get. How do you bounce back from losing your job? How do you bounce back from having difficult relationships with your parents? How do you bounce back from divorce? I've been divorced. How do you, you know, we've all been through, if you live a life of a certain amount of years, for the most part, you're going to go through a lot of peaks and a lot of valleys. And my thing is, I just keep going. I'm blessed with a sort of fearlessness. Not everybody is. So I can't take for granted sometimes when I might judge other people. Now, why aren't you just putting one foot in front of the other and getting up every day and going out there and tackling it again? But I think that it's just a characteristic that I have. And I don't know that it's anything that I sought out. I think I just kind of have it.
So you think it's in your characteristic, not so much a learned characteristic?
I think you have to learn it. I think that I have to sort of channel it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there are people who have to learn it. And I think you can learn it.
Sure,
and I think it's
absolutely.
It's one of the things I love about the program, even though I'm not I've never been addicted to drugs or alcohol.
It's early in the day.
Yeah, well, no, yeah, it's very early in the day. But it's not early in my life. You know, that just wasn't my that's not how I self-soothed. Again, it was just my personality. You know, you can stick a drink in front of me and it drives Paul crazy, you know, because I'll go out and I'll have a glass of wine over a 4-hour period, you know, and he'd be, do you realize if I were still drinking, I would have been on my ninth
fourth bottle.
By
exactly,
now, you know?
Yeah.
And it's like, and sometimes I go, okay, I'll have a second glass. And then I drink like half of it. And he goes, you drank half?
it's inconceivable, even for me.
You know, but for me, that's just it. But then I'll go shop and I'll look at him and I'll go, you're still wearing the same jacket you were wearing last year. Can we go buy you something? I like to shop.
This is your work husband, right?
My work husband, Paul. Williams. But, you know, it's so I think that we need certain guidelines to take us back to the center. And I think that's what the program offers. It's what I always saw in the program. And it's why I wanted to write this book and why I wanted to delve into the concepts and the ideas of what people go through when they get sober. Because I feel that we all need to get sober in our own ways.
Absolutely. It doesn't mean that you're an alcoholic.
It does
we all have
not
ways
mean.
That we have addictions. I mean, if I don't go to the gym at least 5 days a week, I start, my wife's like, you need to go to the gym. You know, we all have our addictions, our vices. And Paul Williams, I mean, he's an icon. Struggled with alcohol. Actually, didn't even struggle with it. He loved it because it masked everything that he felt that he wasn't. The wholeness that was missing.
He was an addict for decades.
And then cocaine.
Heavy cocaine. And you know, if he were here, he would talk about, you know, I can do Paul for Paul, which is how close we are. You know, he would start every day with vodka in the shower.
Thinking there was nothing wrong
with
that.
He would climb out the doggy door to go find his dealer. I hope you're listening, Paul, because I'm doing all your stuff for you, all your bits while you're not here. And that's what he would do. You know, again, I would shop. And it's really interesting because I found, I've kept a diary since I was like 14. I have volumes of them. And I went back and read some old ones recently as I was sorting it through closets, removing. And I found this journal where I was very depressed. I'd been going back and forth between my mother and my father. And I said, you know, I'm really sad today. I'm going to go down to the mall and buy myself a skirt. And it was really interesting for me to see at the age of 14 that I didn't say I'm really sad. I'm going to go raid dad's liquor cabinet and get myself some vodka. I'm going to go call my friend so-and-so and get high. I went down to the mall and bought myself a skirt.
Safer option.
But that was the option I chose. Hmm. And it's still the option I use.
Why do you think you chose shopping?
I think because my grandmother spoiled me. And I have always felt my grandmother was like this would just beacon of love and kind of indulgence.
Were you a girly girl?
Very girly girl. I've always been a girly girl.
Also, you mentioned the word skirt. As a 14-year-old, that's kind of not maybe a 14-year-old typically would use the word dress.
Yeah, I mean, it was just in this, you know, in this little entry in my diary, it happened to be some skirt that had caught my, you know, that was the shiny object that had caught my imagination that day. That was the one I was thinking about that was going to make me feel happy for however many moments shopping makes you happy. Which can pretty much be reduced to moments. But it was just interesting to see that seed of self-soothing was planted at such an early age. And that's the one I continued with. I never liked getting high. I don't really like drinking that much. That just wasn't something that appealed to me. And it wasn't, oh, I was such a, you know, goody two-shoes in any sense of the word, or I was better than anyone else. It just, drinking wasn't my gig.
It made you feel better. So it was a self-fulfilling prophecy. So the template was sort of set. In stone at an early age.
At an early age. And I think, you know, and that's when kids usually, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, I think it's when kids usually start to drink.
Mm-hmm.
You know, 14, 15 is when people start experimenting usually with that. Doesn't mean that's when they're going to dive in head first, but that's when sort of, you know, the peer pressure sets in, no one's around, here's dad's bottle, I got some weed, whatever it may be, that's when kind of the experimentation begins. And then the door opens. And
absolutely.
Then,
you know, I mean, I started lighting up in sixth grade before school.
So there you go. You know, and so I think that many of our habits, I believe this very firmly, you can take back to the headwaters of our childhoods, no question. And at the same time, you can take back our bad habits, perhaps, or our self-destructive habits. They take place and they start setting themselves up in those early years, too. So really, in writing the book, we go back very far into that. And when we tell people to look at their behavior, our first affirmation is something needs to change and it's probably me, which is the I'm going to take responsibility for me. The buck stops here affirmation, which is something I love again about the program that I always felt everyone should have to go through some form of recovery because you can't hand it off to anyone else. You know,
well, that's the hardest thing. Sorry to interrupt you, Tracy, because accepting and understanding that there's an issue can take years and lifetime or can never happen for most people.
Never happen.
Yeah.
Most people. You know, that's...
It's so much easier to live with that denial.
There's no question. And we talk about this in the book, too, which is, of course, if you have, let's say, you know, drug or alcohol is your problem, gambling is your problem, perhaps shopping is your problem.
Eating.
Well, eating is the biggest problem people have. Without question, the more letters, more people we have overweight, in a killer, with the amount of diabetes and heart disease and the rest of it. Sex addiction, which is enormous now, porn on internet. So, you know, people who used to have to go out of their way to find porn, as Paul likes to say, doing you again, Paulie, the devil delivers. That's a Paulie line.
Absolutely.
The devil now delivers. And it's true. So anything you may want to do now in this time of ours, you know, before, let's say if you were a shopaholic, you'd have to wait till the stores open. You know, now it can be 4 a.m. and you're feeling blue and you've had a couple glasses of wine and, you know, every store in the world's available to you. All the porn you want's available. You know, everything is there now. So
24/7 world.
24/7 world. So we really need to get a rein on ourselves. And I agree with you entirely. Most people don't know they have a problem. But with some of the bigger issue problems and the ones we just mentioned, there are ramifications that do appear, without question. You know, if you've lost your job, if you've lost your wife, if you're waking up in the gutter, if you're, you know, hungover every day, if you've just gambled away the family house, whatever it may be, there's no question that
harming others,
eating, you know, that's the one people really seem to have the hardest time coping with, because of course you have to eat, how much you have to eat.
But in this society, of course, we live to eat instead of survive or eat to live.
Well, of course. And then, you know, there's the whole issue of the sugar. I mean, and the government allowing sugar to be in so many foods and kids getting addicted to sugar, which, as you probably know, is as addictive as cocaine, at a very early age. So, you know, the only thing they don't list, if you've ever noticed this, is ingredients on anything. They'll say how many grams of sugar is in something, but they never say what percentage of your daily allotment that is. Go home tonight. Just open your cupboard and look at every single thing in there, from soup to veg. They never say. They say how much fat you're allowed a day, how much salt you're allowed a day. They made a deal with the government in the 70s that they wouldn't do that. So people maybe who aren't educated about nutrition will, have cereal in the morning and have a yogurt and think they're doing the right thing. And bingo, there's their
loaded with
daily
sugar.
Allotment of sugar.
The false labels.
So, you know, you've got young children, you know, they're starting to get addicted and they don't even know it. And it's a very hard thing to break.
It's a huge cycle.
So you have now a diabetes at an all-time high. You have obesity in this country at an all-time high. The people who've moved here from other countries who have no history of it, the Chinese, the Hispanics now have a huge problem here with obesity and diseases they never had when they were home eating their own diets. So it is a big problem, and it's not always our problem. I mean, it's our problem. It becomes our problem. But in the beginning, I think we get lassoed into it.
Something very interesting just hit the paper today, the New York Times. It's very interesting. It's called the 21st Century Cures Bill. Did you see that? It's very in short. It's about the FDA able to fast track medication sooner than later. And at first you're like, okay, great. Maybe that's good. But I hope it's not for profit's sake. Hope it's obviously the research and the DNR. R&D supports everything. But anyway, I just want to throw that out there so our listeners can research that. But when you were growing up, you were always into music and shows, et cetera. And talk about your first meeting with Paul and how crestfallen you were at age 22.
Yeah, I was a big Paul fan when I was a kid. And yeah, even through out of being a kid, because I guess 22, you're no longer a kid.
What was your favorite song of his back then?
Well, my favorite song of Paulie's has always been Dream Away, which is not his most famous song by any stretch of the imagination. But it was the song, it was on Here Comes Inspiration, an album I still listen to. And I lived in Santa Barbara, California. And Paul moved, I'd been to a bunch of Paul concerts. I remember my grandmother taking me to a concert at the Universal Amphitheater, and I was a big Paulie fan. And Paul moved to Santa Barbara, where I lived. And we were very friendly with Dorothy and Robert Mitchum. And Paul and Bob Mitchum were like, you know.
Well, that was huge back then. You kind of glossed over that. How did you become friends
with
the Mitchums?
Well, they were friends. They lived in Santa Barbara. And I knew a lot of people through my mother. So that wasn't like a big deal to me. But I know it's a big deal when you mention Robert Mitchum. But Paul was, and Paul and Bob were very close. And Dorothy was always trying to keep a handle on Bob because, you know, it's recorded throughout history, Bob Mitchum's lore. You know, Bob had drank a lot and did drugs, was one of the first actor to ever go to the prison for smoking pot. And for Paulie, Bob was like an idol. You know, he was this big macho,
larger than life,
larger than life, and that, you know. So for Paul, little Paul Williams, in his eyes, was friends with Bob Mitchum, and they would go get high together. And then Dorothy would, who's trying to be Bob's sheriff, would have to come and, you know, get Bob away from Paul. It was a very funny dynamic. Probably not so funny in some points. But anyway, they had an annual New Year's Day party, and that year they invited Paul. And we always went. And Paul was sort of a recluse when he lived in Santa Barbara, so people really didn't see him very much. The other celebrities that lived there, you always saw. Like Jonathan Winters would stand outside the market every day doing routines. But Paul sort of stayed in his house and did his coke. And so he came to this party, and I was completely overwhelmed with excitement. And he and Bob were kind of standing in the bedroom. Paulie always likes to say we met in Robert Mitchum's bedroom. And I said to Dorothy, I've got to meet Paul Williams. I've got to meet Paul Williams. I've got to meet Paul Williams. And so I went up to him and I said, oh, Mr. Williams, I don't know what I can say on this show. What am I allowed
everything.
To say?
Everything.
Oh, everything. Okay.
Let it go. Let it rip.
So anyway, so I went up to Paul because, I mean, like on our podcast, we just were like, ah, we went crazy. So the great thing now, no censorship. So I went up to Paul and I said, oh, my God, Mr. Williams, you have no idea. I've been a fan of yours forever. I love your music. I mean, and, you know, all that sort of sycophantic fan stuff. And all he wanted to do was go outside and get high with Bob, right? And I'm like, just like, I don't shut up. And he finally looks at me and goes, as long as it got you laid, that's all that matters. Now, I wasn't a virgin, okay, but I was like, and I was a bit, you know, I was kind of a guy freak, but it just burst my Paul Williams bubble. I sort of, you know, got in my car and drove home and went, so much for teenage idols. And
the wind was totally taken out of your
sails. I was like devastated, and that's all he said to me.
Turned around and walked
outside with Bob to go get do some coke, and I'm like standing there in the middle of this party. I hope it got you laid. I mean, that's like the dreaming of the inner child, the broken child, the sad child, you know what I mean? And here you were, like the spokesperson for pain, and it was just all about getting laid. I don't need your music to get laid, Paul. I need it to heal. So
I guess there's a silver lining. I thought you were going to say he came on to you. That would have been even worse.
No, I would have loved that.
Oh, okay.
That I would have been cool with. I was waiting for that.
You should have been mad for him not to have come on you.
No, he didn't come on to me. Coming on to me, I would have been like, fine. I would have been there. No. He did not come
on
to me. Yeah, no, he did not come on to me. At 22, if Paul had come on to me, oh, Paulie. No. He just walked away to coke. He was not interested in me. And that was sort of the end of that story. You know, he stayed in Santa Barbara. Eventually, he left. I went to Los Angeles. I came here.
Pursue your writing.
Pursue my writing. And then, you know, we sort of joke and I say I walked away a Neil Diamond fan. But I continued to listen to Paulie. And he continued to have a place in my heart and in my music heart, if you will. And then I went off and I had a really terrific, roiling career writing TV and films. And I got a deal at Sony Pictures for television. And the first day in, they said, you know, who do you want to do a TV show with? I mean, and out of nowhere, I went, I want to do a show for Paul Williams.
Without even thinking about it.
Not even thinking about it. I just, out of my mouth, right? Who do you want to do a show for?
And he's still going through the thick of all his problems.
Well, you know, you haven't really seen him around much at that point. This was probably 92. And he was just getting sober. I didn't know this because I didn't know him then. Anymore. I mean, I'd seen him that time and then I had never seen him again. So I remember the guy, the producer I was working with, went, well, as long as you back up the truck with cocaine, you know, you can hire Paul Williams, which was a definite.
Great.
I took that as a no. And we went on and did a show with Alex Rocco. And that was that. So I realized, okay, well, I'm not going to, you know, do a show for Paul Williams. And I did a bunch of, yeah, but that. And then we met up again after he'd gotten sober. 10 years later, he was here in New York performing at the, which is now they don't have it anymore, which was the Feinstein Room in the Regency Hotel.
It was a great room, wasn't it?
It was. And I went to hear him.
Shame.
I went to hear him, and I didn't go backstage afterwards. I kept, you know, it was one of those things, you know, when you have this kind of, you know, in your brain, you have this, like, little thought, like, you know, I should go backstage. I thought, no, he's not going to remember. He's just, you know, so I just went home, and then it sort of bothered me all day. And I look for signs. I don't know. Do you look for signs? Are you a sign looker?
You know, I don't look for them, but when they happen, I acknowledge them.
But, like, if you need an answer, do you ever say, just, like, give me a sign that this is...
No.
You don't?
No. But when it happened, I'm like, whoa.
But you recognize
yes.
the sign.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, well, I like ask for them. Like, if I'm, like, uncertain about something, I'll say...
Do you do that at line for lottery tickets?
I don't do the lottery. But I'll, if I have, like, you know, if there's a fork in the road, I kind of go, okay, mm-hmm. which way to go? So I went, I don't know, what should I do about this? So anyway, I'm walking down the street a couple hours later, and I fall in step, oddly. Like, I thought maybe I should just write a note and send it over to his hotel. So I fall in step with these two guys. Not intentionally. I'm just, yeah, as you walk down the streets of New York,
sure.
You fall in step with people.
Sure.
And I start overhearing their conversation. And their conversation went like this. You know that guy? No, which guy? You know the composer guy. Which composer guy? You know, what's his name? William something.
You know, the small guy.
No, that's not where this conversation went, actually. But they went, no, you know, he did Star Wars. Now, of course, they met John Williams, right?
Exactly.
But I took that as a sign, composer Williams, I should write the note. So I went home and I wrote a note.
Interesting.
Had it delivered to his hotel because he was staying at the Regency because he was performing at the Regency. And I said, you know, sorry, you don't know me, but we met many, many years ago at Dorothy and Robert Mitchell's. And proceeded to go on. And he immediately emailed me back. It was early days of email. And we became just instant friends at that moment, from that moment on. And this was, oh, I don't know, like 20 years ago. So that was the beginning of our friendship. And then, you know, we ended up, he actually scored a film for me. And we worked a little bit together. But up until Gratitude and Trust, we'd always looked for something to do together. And that was, you know, so that project came along. And, well, we created that project out of thin air, obviously. But that was the project that we worked on. And we will be known for, sort of joined for life on doing that project.
Tracy Jackson's my guest. She's a co-author of Gratitude and Trust, Six Affirmations That Will Change Your Life, New York Times bestseller. She wrote it with Paul Williams. Now, what was it that actually, obviously you were burned once with Paul. All these years later, you see him and you get together after an email. What was it that made you trust him? Did you see the change in his sobriety?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, from the get, well, he was sober. By the time I met Paul, he was sober mm-hmm. 10 years. So,
well, 10 years, that's a good stretch.
Yeah. So really he was sober. I mean, he was really, really, he wasn't just newly sober at that point. He was really sober. And
you had a solid career.
And, well, he was coming back. You
now,
know,
your career was very solid.
My career was very solid. My career was actually at that point probably in some ways more solid than his. You know, I mean, I was working in film and TV and he was not working as much. He didn't want to work as much. After he got sober, he went back and he did what a lot of people do, which is he was working with people, getting them sober. I mean, his life was really about sobriety for many, many years.
And
you know, it's equally divided, I would say, now between ASCAP and sobriety. And he still does some performing. So he's, you know, even at this age, I mean, he'll admit that he just turned 76 years old and he's this ridiculous energy. I mean,
yeah. He looks amazing.
You know, and he's got this energy.
For a guy
like,
put himself through the ringer, he looks great.
And he's little, I'd say yeah. that to him. I, you know, his brother mentor who wrote Drift Away, mm-hmm. you know, yeah, he sadly just passed away at the age of 70. I mean, Paul's, you know, last remaining member of his family.
Was that tough for
yeah,
Paul?
Yeah, it was really tough to see mentor go, and that was just really recently. And so what I saw in Paul, which I saw in many friends of mine who'd gone through the program, that he was just a different person. You know, you could trust him. He spoke from his heart. You didn't feel your... Mm. There's something about people who've been through recovery who are just... There's an honesty. And I responded to that in a big way. So, yes, I trust him very much. And I had another friend who I've lost, sadly, a man called Blake Snyder, who wrote a book called Save the Cat, which has become sort of the definitive screenwriting book. And Blake went through the same thing. You know? So I'd seen a lot of people really transformed by this.
And it's great that people can transform, because sometimes people come back as dry drunks.
Yeah.
And very bitter and angry.
And there's no question. And so Paul didn't do that. And
two. I'm back. Yes, I am.
Okay. We did. Oh, we did. We're live.
Am I good, Zach? You dropped my mic there for a while.
I think my mic is my mic live.
Are we live? Yeah, you're good.
I'm good. Okay. So, you know, so Paul was, yeah, there's never any question of trusting Paul. But it's what kind of, it's not what kind of, I don't have to qualify it. It's what really propelled me to, that people should do this. You know, I used to walk around going, well, everyone should just go into recovery. Everyone should have 1 year.
Or at least therapy, some form
of
therapy.
Well, I think therapy is very different. And I've been through therapy, God knows, most of my life. But therapy, you got one person there who's on your side and kind of mirrors back to you oftentimes And it's very valuable. And I think people should go to therapy. And therapy is also much more expensive. Let's face it. Not everyone can afford therapy. And I've had my therapist has said there's been so many people in this practice that I've wanted to send into AA, but I couldn't because they didn't have drink problems. There's a structure to AA that it's not, you don't get that in therapy. You don't get those steps. You don't get that kind of blueprint of how to go forward, how to get yourself out of the trenches, how to, you know, give to people, how to take accountability for your life on a daily basis, how to, you know, there's just gold. There's gold
point.
In them.
Yeah,
in them.
Absolutely.
You know, there's just gold in them steps.
Well, it makes you have to look into crevices of your own self that you possibly have never had to do before. And that's what alcohol did. That was the Band-Aid.
Absolutely. And I somehow recognized this, even as a non-alcoholic and a non.
So how did you recognize that in yourself?
Well, I recognized that this was valuable, that I recognized that taking responsibility. I think that, you know, I wanted the people around me to take responsibility, too. I think it went back to my childhood. And I'd seen what it had done for people who were so on the edge, you know, and then it brought them back. And it brought them back better. And they were better than the people I knew who hadn't been down
that
path,
point, sure.
Who didn't go to meetings, who didn't have to go into a room every day and account for their behavior, that, you know, there's something really powerful in that, and it keeps you on the straight and narrow, hopefully. And it's not foolproof, and we all know that, and then people are writing, oh, it's not foolproof. No, nothing's foolproof, but if you work it, it does work. And
it's better than the alternative.
It certainly is. And so it was something that I just had been always kind of back-burnered in my brain, but I'd never had an outlet for it. And one day I was, Paul did a wonderful documentary called Paul Williams Staying Alive, which kind of charts his fame and then downfall and then rise again. It's a wonderful documentary.
And the clips are amazing.
And for those of you who haven't seen it, it's a terrific documentary and you can find it on iTunes. But he was speaking after a showing of it, and in a Q&A, he'd said something that to the effect of his choo-choo ran on the twin rails of gratitude and trust. And there was just something about those two words conjoined that really struck me. And it just, the light bulb went off sitting there in the audience. And I went, gratitude and trust, recovery is not just for addicts.
Yeah,
and afterwards, I went up to Paulie and I said, look, that's it. We write a book, gratitude and trust, recovery is not just for addicts.
And sorry to interrupt you here, because I have to mention, like, going into the title, the metaphor, but the literal aspect of how far can you exist on those?
On gratitude and trust?
Very far versus the alternative, alcohol, drugs, or
absolutely,
whatever your vice can be.
Yeah, I mean, I think that trust these days in this environment
here we go, exactly.
Is a little bit harder for me.
Join the club.
And I think that's something that I'm dealing with, and I'm dealing with...
As a
society we're dealing with, and our readership and the people I know who are...
Giving you new material
pain.
To blog about.
Yeah, it gives me a lot of material to blog about. But, you know, trust right now is... that's a little bit harder, and the universe does throw curveballs your way. And I don't know that we have no choice but to trust, but we certainly have no choice but to get through it. So you know, we sat down and we wrote the book, and we have a website, www.gratitudeandtrust.com.
So was it hard for you at that point, or have you at that point realized all the things that were your vices that were making you do things that maybe weren't allowing you to be as happy as you could be? You were certainly a mother of two by then, married for many years, so certainly... the line of men had ceased a long time ago. Shopping, I guess, had diminished, hopefully. was there one pivotal time in your life where you said, hey, listen, this isn't really working?
Oh, I think, you know, it's an interesting question. I find that every 7 years, I have this sort of cataclysmic or seismic shift in my life where I go, this isn't working. And, you know, it's been different things. There was certainly at the end of my 20s, the kind of parade of men and the kind of living the life of a girl who goes out a lot and makes the wrong choices.
And the field that you're in, it was so easy.
I could see, you know, a lot of my friends were getting married and they were settling down and this was something I wanted. So that was, I remember sort of having a big moment of falling down and looking at myself in the mirror and going, wow, okay, only you can fix this one. And then really went into therapy quite seriously and got myself, and then I was you know, married by 30 and had a child by 31 and had a TV show on the air by 31 and really sort of turned my life around.
That's pretty early.
Yeah.
For all of that to happen.
Yeah. And then sort of.
In that field especially.
The end of my 30s, that marriage was not good, which I kind of knew from the middle. And I really had to get myself out of that marriage by 40. And I had to make a big seismic shift in my life again.
How difficult was that to make that decision?
You know, it's really interesting about leaving a marriage. And I talk to people about this because even when a marriage is broken, it's still very hard to leave. And I think that if anyone who's been through a divorce will understand this. And then all of you sitting out there who are unhappy in your marriage is wondering how to get out of it. It's a very hard thing to do. And what I've learned is...
Especially when there's kids involved. You had one child then?
I had one child. But I think that... But you still, you know, you're home and you're family and you had all these hopes and dreams and they're not working.
And there's still the what ifs.
And there's what ifs. Even though you've kind of maybe burned a lot of what ifs. But they're... You don't want to do it in the absolute, but you know you have to do it in the absolute. So you're really stuck. And I think, and I've made a kind of observation of this and interviewed people and talked about it quite a lot. One person has the courage. You will find a marriage where it ends. One person has the courage to walk out of that marriage. I would still be married to my first husband probably if I hadn't had the courage to leave. And you know, and even at the end, it was very sad and I wanted to leave and I was packing up my house and, you know, it was very sad. I remember crying and even, and I remember saying to him, you know, look, we don't make each other happy. This just is, you, do you know what I mean? And we're not going to learn to make each other happy because we can't. We're just not meant to make each other happy. It takes courage. There are a lot of miserable marriages out there. There are a lot of divorces and there's a lot of people who just sleepwalk through their lives and accept bad relationships for whatever reason they're doing it.
And that kind of mirrors your second tenet. I don't know how to do this, but.
But something inside me does. And so that was the end of that decade, sort of, you know, 38, 39, was getting out of that marriage, meeting my present husband.
How much time in between?
45 minutes. maybe there was an overlap. But then, you know, I also knew that I could have, if I got out of it by 40, I set time limits for myself. And so maybe that's the writer in me. I set deadlines.
Absolutely, deadlines. Sure, you lived by them.
So I said by 40, I got to be out of here. Because by 40, I can still meet someone else, have another baby, hopefully, and start again. And I did. I had another baby at 42, moved to New York again, and then in the end of my 40s,
reinvention time.
I had to reinvent myself because the writer's strike came along. The brand of comedy that I wrote was no longer popular. I was considered an older woman in Hollywood.
Had you done movies at this point?
Oh, yeah. I mean,
So you had the three under your belt?
Yeah, but, you know, Confessions of a Shopaholic, we should have made $150 million. It made $30. If it had made $150, I would have probably bought myself five more years. You know, Hollywood works on strange kind of barter system. So I could, and then the writer's strike happened and that tossed a lot of people out and reality TV happened and then they realized they didn't have to use writers in the same way. So there was the business changed and I
huge shift.
And I had to change with it, which took me a couple of years to figure out.
And were you accepting of that?
Not in the beginning. No, I went through a whole hesitant Elizabeth Kubler-Ross thing of not accepting and then accepting and then being angry and then being sad. And, you know, I write about this all in my first book. And then I reinvented myself. I made the documentary, which was fantastic. I wrote my first book. I wrote the book with Paul.
Was your first book easy? Did it?
Yeah,
was it a work
it
of just opening up the floodgates and
writing is easy
cathartic
for me. I mean, I'm very blessed that
but
writing,
that was about yourself.
It
though,
was about myself. It wasn't as hard as writing Gratitude and Trust because Gratitude and Trust was something I really had to. It was a different process, but
different insights.
Yeah. I mean, I remember signing the contract on my first book and walking down the street and saying, wait a minute, I just signed a contract. I do this all the time in my life, by the way. I just start projects without knowing anything about them and just go, I'll just figure this out as
I go. I don't think you're alone. You're not alone.
So, you know, I made a documentary and the first day I got on the set, I went, I don't know how to do this, but someone around here does. And then the book, I don't know how to write a book, but I did. I mean, I wrote it. And
are you still happy with it?
I love it. I love that book, actually. I mean, it sounds obnoxious. I love it. But when I think about things that I want to say to people, I always go, a lot of them are in that book. You know, a lot of my feelings are in that book.
Well, a lot of times when we distance ourselves from projects, we're always growing. So sometimes when we look back, you're like, I can't believe I wrote it in that fashion. So it's,
no,
it's about you. So you haven't changed of who you were then. So I guess it would still make sense to like it.
Well, I think, you know, it's interesting. When I look back at things I did in my early career, things people liked, paid a lot of money for. I look at those things and I go, I wouldn't have bought that, or I would didn't.
Well, I guess because you were writing for the masses.
Not only that, I was just younger. I just didn't have the technique I may have now. But and that's only, and I say that to anyone out there who wants to write, because so many people do. That only comes from, you know, as Malcolm Gladwell says, the 10,000 hours of practice. It just, you know, I never stop. And you ask kind of about the grit and the fortitude. You know, even when I'm not paid to write, you know, I've been paid massive amounts of money to write, and I've been paid nothing to write. And I've always gotten myself back on track by going out and writing for nothing. I mean, it's, you know, whenever I've sort of like had to go back and find my way, I go back and I don't write for money. I write for myself, and that somehow takes me to a place where someone is going to pay for it or buy it, or I'm back in the game. And it's never failed. And
anonymously or under your name?
No, under my name, but I go away and I write. And I write to find my voice again and find myself again. And I never stopped writing. I've been blogging for 9 years for no money. I still do it all the time.
You think this keeps you humble as well?
Perhaps it also just keeps me, I think, as long as you're doing something, you feel like you're in the game and irrelevant.
And you have to do it to be relevant.
And you have to do it, and you have to think, you know, outside of the box. So there was that shift at 48, and then I wrote the two books, and I did the documentary and got a movie out of the week out of one of the books. And then, you know, at the end of the project with Paul, to be honest with you, okay, now I'm 58. I mean, it's, no one has to lie about their age anymore, because
you look
just
damn good.
Well, thanks. But you know, it's
right. Well, you know, living in New York's good. You got to keep your game on, and you certainly have done that.
Thank you. But you know, everyone can Google you, so you can lie all you want. I can sit here and say I'm 38, but they go Google me. It's right there. And then, you know, this year at the end of I put 4 years into Gratitude and Trust with Paul. But that's
a long time to co-author a project.
Yeah, we travel and we still speak at places.
Especially
and all.
With an addict.
Yeah, well, yeah. I mean,
touring,
I have
boring schedules.
I have a longer attention span,
right?
Yeah, I have a longer attention span than Paulie, and he would admit that. You know, but you know, it was time to move on to something else, and I sat down, and I really wanted to go back to TV. I think TV has gotten to be awesome. I'm not the only one to say that. Obviously, it's not a revelation. But, you know, TV, you can be free. There is so many channels now. There's so many outlets. It's like
I think they've been forced to become better.
They've been forced to become better. And so I just said, I want to go back to TV for a while. And I sat down last year and very silently again, you know, no one paid me. I didn't go out and pitch it. I didn't go out and get any money. I didn't go out and get a deal. I just said to my agent, I'm going to go away for 6 months and I'm going to write a pilot. And I did, and I sold it.
Sitcom?
It's a dramedy. And, you know, I'm back in the game. So it's kind of amazing that I am at 58, you know, back in the game. But again, it's just going back and doing the work. And I think it's the one thing I always want to impress upon people. And then Paul and I did a podcast, okay? We got paid nothing. We did it for 9 months. And we loved it. But we went in there
and we got your message out.
We got our message out. And we loved it, and we interviewed extraordinary people. And as you know, by doing it, you get to meet so many wonderful people,
God,
and you get
amazing.
The best conversations.
And the best thing about it is finding out what makes them tick.
Yeah.
It's great.
It's
There's
great.
Nothing,
oh,
nothing
no, it's so exhilarating.
Absolutely.
It's so exhilarating.
So excuse me, I want to get to your pilot, because I know you glossed over that. Two things. Number one, isn't it a shame that you have to keep, and this is not an attack on you by any means, Tracy, that you have to keep saying to yourself, at 58, it's amazing that I can X, Y, and Z. It's a shame you're a talented person. There's so many incredibly talented and seasoned people with sage advice and insight, and they have to validate it by their age that it's so good that they can still be doing this. And it's a shame. And also, I want to hear your take on your gender. Is it even more of a hurdle because you're 58 and a woman?
Oh, I've written about this extensively. There's no question. You know, and people don't like to hear it, but there is no question that, well, first of all, yeah, in comedy, and as you know, that, you know, women have to, it's, you know what I think it is? You got to work harder. And I don't know that men understand this. I'll have this conversation with my husband, who is, you know, is extremely good at what he does, and has sort of cornered the market. He did, you would like this because you're rocking. He's the one who sold the Bob Dylan archives.
Oh, really?
Yeah. He sells archives and manuscripts and is now mostly into music, which is interesting because sort of he went from, you know, Nabokov now to Dylan. But, you know.
A natural segue.
But he, you know, he doesn't really get it at times. And I'll go, you know, like, I can't make the third call like you can because I'm a woman and that makes me pushy. I can't, because I've been accused of being pushy, and I am pushy, but is it pushy or I'm just very intent on what I'm doing and my goals? And yes, it's very hard to be a woman. I didn't understand that as much until I got to be older. It's not so hard really to be a younger woman because people like having younger women around more than they like having older women around. That's just a fact. So when I was younger, it was easier in many ways. But it's not an excuse, you know? It's an explanation, but it's not an excuse. And you have to push back it. You have to keep going forward, and you have to get past it. And you can. I'm a firm believer in that. But it takes a certain amount of fortitude in getting up and just doing the job. And a lot of people just go, well, I can't because I'm a woman. And you get a lot of criticism. You know, you get a lot of criticism. You get... especially if you're funny and you're a woman, and you know, it's like it's attractive to be funny in a guy. It's not quite as attractive in women, even though there's been a kind of shift in that. But then a lot of funny women have really had to play off of their not being attractive, you know. And you can look at from Joan Rivers, who started it, to Sarah Silverman, to Amy Schumer, you know, Kathy Griffin. I mean, you know, so female comedians really tend to have to play off of not being pretty, of not being attractive, of not being sexual objects. And that's not really fair. And I think that, but it exists, and one would have to, you know, be crazy to deny it.
And they can validate that because it gives themselves fodder to be out there.
Sure, but you have to kind of do that. I mean, you don't have to do it when you write the way I do, but you just have to...
couch it in a way that it's not demeaning.
Yeah, I think what's
for the most part
more distressing, and I thought you were kind of going that way in your question, it's not distressing. It gets exhausting, which is the reinvention of yourself. And I think that that's a big deal. I think that, now more than ever, there's a wonderful book by a man called Roman Kasnerov about how to find fulfilling work, which I always tell everybody to read. It's a little paperback. It costs nothing, like $8. It's called How to Find Fulfilling Work. And it talks about how our generation, this generation, and the coming generations, that there was a time, and we see this now, and we see this from the outcrop of this election, of a lot of what's happened, is that, you know, you got a job, you know, whatever it was, your 20s, for the most part, be it a lawyer or a factory worker, and you kept that job, and you put in your time,
got your 401k, your watch,
and you had your money in your house,
parachute,
and, you know, that was your life. And the world does not exist with those rules anymore. So, you know, even this whole Rust Belt thing, technology has taken many more jobs than immigrants. You know, technology is now going to take over driving. So everyone has to kind of, in Hollywood or in you know, either in film business or in comedy or in writing or else, you are constantly inventing yourself because you always constantly have to get a new job.
Hmm.
You know, you don't
everything's in flux.
You don't have a job for life. If you choose to be in the business that I'm in, or you don't get a job for life. You don't get security. You have to constantly reinvent yourself.
And with that job, the pressure is immense, I imagine, for performance. It's all about numbers, ratings.
It's all about numbers. It's all about hitting the ball out of the park. It's all about being really totally original. But then sort of being mainstream. It's a very, I think TV now, is what's great is you don't have to be mainstream. That's what kind of makes TV so fabulous right now.
And how much energy did that take from you?
You know, I've never thought of it in terms of energy output because I'm the happiest working. So
gotcha.
I don't mind doing
sure.
it. I would be much more unhappy if I didn't get to do it.
I'm the same way.
I feel very blessed that I love to do it, and I feel very blessed that it makes me happy, and there's no amount of work that seems like it's too much for me. And I used to tell when I taught writing, which I did for 10 years, I taught screenwriting, and everybody's, you know, wanted an agent and wanted a film done right away. You know, there's this kind of immediate gratification that we all have. And I would say, if you don't love the process, then don't do it, because it's mostly process.
Or create your own process.
And I say that for everyone. But if you don't love to write, don't write.
Sure.
If you don't love to talk to people, don't get yourself, you know, a radio show. Do you know what I mean? If you don't, you have to like what you're doing, because there are going to be times when what you're doing isn't going to be accepted. And you're going to have to go through that time and get to the other side by just the mere joy of liking what you do.
And or, sticking it out.
And sticking it out. Or the imagination to think up a new way to do it that fits in with the new climate. Because if you live long enough and you work long enough, the climate is going to change. Mm. The style is going to change. What's popular is going to change.
Reinvention.
The format's going to change. Look at how many times the format's changed since you and I have been working.
Well, you know, it's interesting because about 6-7 years ago, when I realized the digital format was obviously getting larger and larger and looming and my radio station was sold, I'm like, well, that's okay. I got a plan B. I'm going to start a speaking business because I have so many different, you know, vast life experiences that I can tap into that we spoke about off the air before the show started that it's been working out for me. But I'm not alone. I mean, there's so many people in the radio industry and other industries. I always actually kid around Tracy Jackson that the rest of the world is like radio now, because radio has always been like the short shelf life.
Right.
And you have to be, I mean, as a creative director, a talk show host, and a lot of different things, because you have to wear multiple hats.
And you have to be willing to change those hats.
Absolutely.
And so many people are not. They go, but I've been doing this for 10 years and I'm really good. And they go,
and
okay,
so what?
And that's great.
And you're archaic.
Now let's go do something else. And I know so many people who, I'm really good at promoting books, and people will come to me and they go, how do I promote my book? And, you know, when I write a book, I build out the website before I've even start writing. You know, I mean, we had Gratitude and Trust up before we got our deal, and the day we closed our deal, the site went live, you know, and we had a whole following before that book was published. You know, you have to just think of lots of ways to do things and do them. So, but you have to be willing to move with the time. So I think even when you say, like, okay, 58 years old, yeah, but I'm really good at social media. You have to be good at social media. You know, you don't have a choice now.
Or be
now.
Able to have somebody do it for you.
Yeah, but even then, you know, it's better kind of
sure.
if you can do it yourself.
In a timely fashion.
I think that, you know, but I think you have to have an understanding of it and what it means.
All
and
the
I
moving
think,
parts. Yeah.
And I think a lot of people go, well, I don't want to get involved with all that Twitter.
It's not
I don't
me.
Want to do that Instagram. My dogs have an Instagram account, okay? And someone wrote in yesterday and said,
and they write better than most people, you know. No, right.
Well, I write for them. Okay. But someone said, you know, they're so popular. Can they come and have like a meet and greet? I thought, my dogs are so popular that they want to go
That's
and they have
great.
Like a public.
Only in New York City, right?
Only there. It's called Winnie and Wednesday's World on Instagram, ladies and gentlemen.
Wow. You do love to write.
Well, I I write for my dogs. Sometimes my kids will say, Mom, do you realize you've been talking to Welly the Wiener for a half hour? Nobody is nicer. I just have to put a plug in for these people, okay? I have these two new, I've always had dogs, but I have these two new really truly adorable dogs. And I started this Instagram account for them. Well, my kids did, but like all things your children do, you end up taking over half the time. So I started this Instagram account for my dogs. There's so much negativity online, and I think we've all been seeing so much of this now on our Facebook pages, on our Twitter accounts. I mean, this last 6 months has just been just a cesspool if you're involved in social media.
A sea of it.
And, you know, the people who attack you. I mean, it's just, we all hear it. We've all seen it. We've all been there. If you're
Pretty
there.
Ugly. Absolutely.
It's really ugly. The dog people are the nicest people you will ever meet online. I'm telling you, they never say a bad word. All they do is like your stuff. All they do is promote you. All they are is sweet. Whenever I'm feeling blue, whenever I'm feeling like internet
it's true.
Sucks.
I've seen this. And I'm
telling you,
it.
I go to my dog
time
site.
And time again,
and literally my daughter will say, Mom, okay, now you're talking to Mr. Fribble and it's been 20 minutes. I will like Winnie and Wednesday, my dogs will like talk to the other dogs because obviously dogs don't talk. I know that. But they have to talk to their dog followers. These people just, they look.
Well, hey, that's a healthy vice.
Exaltation, absolutely. So anyway, if you do feel sad, guys, and you think that the internet really is a terrible place right now and people are just attacking each other, go find some dogs to follow and you will really see some happiness because they are very good people.
Tracy, we only have a few minutes left. And my Lord, I never would have thought this much time would have passed. And I have so much more material to cover. And it's been such a pleasure speaking with you on so many different levels. But I want to talk about Paul for a second here. We've talked about all the things you've overcome. What about his daily struggles? Does he daily, because a lot of addicts struggle on a daily basis with drinks, with narcotics, whatever the substance or whatever brought him down of choice was. How difficult, how many years later, 28 years later?
I think Paul's 27 years
27
sober.
Years sober. How difficult 26? Is it for him still?
I've never seen it be difficult for him.
Wow.
I've never seen Paulie, and I've spent as much time with Paulie as anyone. I mean, except maybe his wife. But the years we were on the road, I mean, we spent more time together than with anyone else. I've never seen Paul, I'll ask him. I'll say, you know, like, do you want a drink? Like sitting here, you know, because, well, you know, you'll be at a party or you'll be late at night somewhere. Or you'll be like in a, you know, meeting someone in a bar. You know, because Paulie will go into a bar. I mean, Paulie doesn't. And he said, he always says, you know, that I'm so grateful every day for being sober, that the trade-off of what sobriety feels like and what my life is and the gifts I've been given and the responsibility I've been given with ASCAP and the joy I get in getting people sober and helping people.
And the music that he's created.
And the wonderful music he's created in sobriety. You know, because the question that Paulie gets asked the most often probably, and I think it's something that a lot of musicians and a lot of creative people get asked who get sober, and you know where I'm going, you need that stuff to be creative. You need to be high to be cool. You need to be high to tap into it, which is such a lie, and it's so not true. That Lou Reed and everyone created their best stuff when they were on heroin, whatever. Not true. So, you know, and Paul will even talk very eloquently about that a lot of the stuff he wrote when he was high was just shit and he'd have to wake up the next morning and get sober and rewrite it. So, you know, Paul's done wonderful work since he's been sober and it's not hard for him. Now, I have friends who've been sober and they'll remain nameless and they are sober, who it is a struggle for. Who when they reach hard times, they do call up and say, "I really want to go get a drink. Mm-hmm. I really
need
help." Go to
a meeting.
You know,
call a friend.
You know, so
avoid certain places.
But that's not Paul Williams. You know, he does not struggle with that as a. You know, sometimes when life is tough, and he goes, you know, because just because he's Paul Williams doesn't mean his life doesn't have issues. All our lives have issues. I will hear him say, "I just really need to go to a meeting." And that's not because he wants to drink. It's just because he needs an outlet.
Sure.
For
need
whatever.
A reminder. You need a support system.
He needs a support group. But no, it's not hard for him to be sober at all. It's a joy for him to be sober. It's a gift for him to be sober. And that's part of the light that shines around him. It's not
what
a struggle.
Incredible team you guys make. Paul Williams and Tracy Jackson. Gratitude and Trust, 6 Affirmations That Will Change Your Life. New York Times bestseller and published by...
published by Blue Rider Press, Viking Penguin.
And your website,
Tracy? Well, there's www.tracyjacksononline.com, where you get kind of the not as grateful me. And then there's Gratitude and Trust, where you get the more grateful me and Paul from time to time. And there's Winnie and Wednesday's World, where you can see my really cute dogs.
Oh, yes. Well, I'm grateful for your time, Tracy
Thank
Jackson.
Thank you.
What
I'm
a
grateful
supreme
for this.
Pleasure. My name is Mark Farrell. The show has been Insight in a Progressive Radio Network. If you'd like me to speak at your school, college, or workplace, MarkFarrellMotivation.com. Have a great day. Gary Knowles next.